May it please the court.
Wait just a minute. You guys, have you picked your sides yet? All right. We hear argument from the petition.
May it please the court, Mr. K. Ray Campbell will present an argument for the petition.
I'm with the law firm of Burns Myers, Adair Campbell and Senex, Houston, and I represent Mr. J. Siskin, the plaintiff in this cause of action. And it's a special appearance to the jurisdiction of the court under Rule 128, the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, and Article 2031B, the long-arm statute of Texas. The brief summary of the case is that Mr. Siskin's son was enrolled in the Villa Foundation School in Arizona in January of 79. He completed the last half of the school year there at or about the time the school year was over. Summer vacation started. He was invited to return by a letter soliciting his enrollment, which was mailed to his parents in Houston, Texas, Mr. and Mrs. Siskin, and with an enrollment application attached. Mr. Siskin executed the enrollment application, made the deposit, made some minor alterations in the contract, and one significant alteration was which deleted the reference to the fact that any controversy in the matter would be litigated in the courts of Arizona, leaving it up for whatever forum had jurisdiction to litigate a cause of action should one arise. They accepted the application and contract, which also was a contract under those conditions. And in connection with that, it brings into play Rule 2031B, Section 4, which was amended in 1979. And I would like to read the last sentence of that amended section, which was in essence the amendment. The act of recruiting Texas residents directly or through an intermediary located in Texas for employment inside or outside of Texas shall be deemed doing business in this state. In this connection, Siskin's son, Mark, was recruited in a very similar manner that you would recruit somebody for employment to go to some distant place and work. And he did go to Arizona. He attended school. He was dismissed or expelled, as you, whichever you please choose, whichever way you, you want to look at it, in November. And there was no refund made as provided for in the contract, nor was there evidence submitted to show that none was due. They refused to correspond or make any representations or verify their, or justify their position. This is very close to the 2031B4. I draw a very close analogy to that section to the statute in California that was relied on in the case of McGee versus International Life Insurance Company. In this particular case, since the school solicited the contract from Mark, now there's a distinction between the first enrollment in which Mr. Siskin contacted the school and inquired of enrollment. That was in the spring semester. The second term that he was enrolled was a completely new contract. There was no continuing obligation or carryover or anything. It was not a renewal. It was a complete new and separate contract that stood on its own. And the difference in the two was that the school contacted Mr. Siskin in the second instance, which is the contract before this court. In this case, carry on. Villa School has about 80 students, according to Mr. Steinbeck's testimony. And I might admit the discovery was very difficult in this case. We did not get all of the interrogatories answered that we wanted. We would have a better record had we done so. But there's 10 students, or approximately 8 students, from Texas. So therefore, if they have an enrollment of 80 students, 10% of their income comes from the state of Texas. 10% of their student body is enrolled by the school soliciting their re-enrollment in the fall of 79, just like they did in Mark Siskin's case. In this particular case, Mr. Steinbeck testified in Statement of Facts on page 7, when questioned by Mr. Smith, that all defendants are residents of Arizona. Under the Rule 120A, in Vice, in the case of also supported by Vines versus Harry Newton, Inc., the burden is on the defendant to prove that they do not come within the jurisdiction of the forum. They only testified that they were residents of Arizona. They did not testify that they were not. Mrs. Steinbeck testified on behalf of all of them, by the way. There was no testimony, nothing in the record to show that any of the defendants other than Mrs. Steinbeck did not have more than one residence. And as you know, you can only have one domicile, but you can have many residents. That answer, that question is unanswered and was not asked. And it was, therefore, the record, you'd have to assume that it was not, they did not meet their obligations under 120A to negate all possibilities of jurisdiction under Texas law and mark statute. This is very similar to the case in Main Bank versus Nye, where only evidence by defendant was an affidavit as to place of residence. There the defendant submitted an affidavit that he was not a resident of the state. The court said that was bordered on hearsay because there was no opportunity to cross-examine. In our particular case, I draw an analogy to that case because we had no duty to come forward and prove their duty under 120A that they were not residents. That was the defendant's obligation to come forth with that evidence, which they failed to do in the trial court on the hearing. In our first point of error, we feel that the minimum contact as required under the Texas long-arm statute 2031B section 4 has been met. I realize that many of the Texas cases, in fact most of them, apply a three-prong test. But almost to a case, the federal courts have, since International Shoe, applied a two-point test. And the minimum contacts are the fair and reasonable. That's the only two you have to meet, according to the federal court. We think there is minimum contact, adequate minimum contact, because 10% of their student body comes from Texas. And they are, there's no evidence in the record to show that this school is a private foundation or a, that it is not a profit-making entity. In fact, we think it is a privately held corporation that operates for a profit. It's not a non-profit institution. But that is our belief. There again, we have not been able to get to the bottom of all the things we want to on discovery.
What difference would it make if it was a non-profit corporation?
Because the defendant cited the case involving a student, I have it here somewhere, and the defendant was Loyola University, in which the student was in junior college in Florida. The basketball coach at Loyola carried on extensive negotiations by telephone and what have you with the student in Florida. They offered him a scholarship. They mailed the scholarship contract to Florida. The student signed it. Then it was forwarded to Tennessee to be signed by the father. And then it was forwarded back to New Orleans at Loyola University. and then they changed basketball coach, and the new coach would not honor the contract. So the father brought suit on the Tennessee long-arm statute, and the court, of course, said there was not sufficient minimum contact. And then it went on to allude to the fact that it was against public policy for small institutions that were not profit-making institutions to be taxed with this burden of having to go to Tennessee. And they said there was no profit to be realized out of this transaction in
not
the state of Tennessee.
Not many colleges that I know of make a profit.
I beg your pardon, sir?
Not many colleges that I know of make a profit.
I realize that, but this is a privately endowed college.
So is Baylor. So is SMU.
That is correct, John. And
then,
but
got
this
a different rule for University of Texas and Baylor. And
but
I don't make any money that I know. I just don't see the relevance of that.
Okay, but Villa School is a profit-making institution. And the court went off on the idea, if it's a business and the state of Tennessee can expect it to receive a profit from the transaction and the defendant is expected to receive a profit, then it has a different emphasis. And this is what the court, all I'm reciting is the rationale as cited in the case by the court, Your Honor. And
I don't think you really need that case, counsel. You've got other cases.
No, he cited the case, and I'm drawing the distinction between his case, Your Honor. Okay. I agree with you. I don't think it's relevant. I think you're talking about oranges and apples. I believe that the case has no bearing here whatsoever. Okay. Plus the fact, since the school realizes approximately 10% of its income from Texas, it solicits these re-enrollments. It advertises throughout the state of Texas in national magazines. It has its phone number listed in many of the phone books in the state of Texas, as admitted by Mrs. Steinbeck, that we feel like that they are doing business in Texas. If you have 10% of your livelihood coming from the state of Texas, I don't see how you can turn on the next rent and say, but I'm not doing any business in Texas whatsoever. And you have all kind of correspondence and what have you, and communications back and forth between them. And the Arizona institution mailed, solicited it in Texas. I believe under
if Baylor of Texas recruits somebody from Arkansas, Baylor is doing business in Arkansas, is that what you're saying?
Not per se. If they recruit somebody, if 10% of their student body, 10% of the income from that keeps that institution going came from Arkansas, and I would suggest that they are in Arkansas doing business for the purpose of the long-arm statute. If they breach some of their contract in connection with that student body. And also, the Texas courts have had usually said the number two prong of the three-prong test had to be that the breach had to arise out of the transaction. However, in your recent case for this court in Helico, court, which came down in February the 27th of 72, case number 243, the court says, we recognize that a nexus between the cause of action and the defendant's contact with the forum state is not a rigid due process requirement. It is, however, a significant factor to be considered when evaluating the fairness of the exercise of jurisdiction in a given case. A cause of action is certainly against a non-resident defendant that does not arise out of something that done in the forum state compels proof of more positive contact with the forum than a cause of action that is connected with the defendant's activities in the state. We think the defendant's activities in the state are significant enough to overcome the second prong that this court and this court from Texas have felt from time to time was necessary. And also, in going on, in the product Promotions Inc. versus Constu in the Fifth Circuit, the Texas courts have held that it is dissimilar to that. However, I believe in your case and the case here in Hall versus Helico, that you said you would let that stand, and also the O'Brien test you were going to let stand, which only required a two-prong test. So based on that, we feel that Villa School has met the test sufficient, because it should expect, if it does 10% of its business here, to come into the state of Texas and afford itself the use of Texas courts and Texas facilities in enforcing its rights and furthering its livelihood. And because that is a significant amount. In one case I cited where there was only 10%, I mean only 0.2% of the firm's livelihood came from the state of Texas. But yet the court said that was activities within the state of Texas, even though they were unrelated, which was sufficient enough to bring them under Texas long-arm statute. And in our case, it's approximately 10%. Another thing I would like to add, if we have a corporation here that's operating for a profit, it's a going business, I think it's grossly unfair to expect the people of a state where it gets 10% of its business to have to go to Arizona to get its day in court for a breach of contract. We filed suit in Arizona after we were dismissed in district court in Harris County, strictly for the purpose of tolling any statute of limitations that might be running on us in Arizona as a result of the court, the case having been dismissed in the district court. And we did that for the purpose of then proceeding with our appeal. But that's the only reason that that case was filed. And contrary to what the defendants have said in their plea for abatement, they said it would be unfair for and not within the spirit of comedy for the case to, a second case to be filed in Texas. That's not the case. The second case was filed in Arizona. If this court reinstates this judgment, it will still be the first case. We go back to the same court we were. We will not have to file over. This judgment will be vacated and the first case will continue on. So there is a second case pending in order to prevent the statute of limitations from running against us. In the next, we feel that Villa has maintained a continuous course of conduct in the state of Texas. In most all of the cases cited by the defendant, where the minimum contact question was the main question, it was one transaction, one isolated transaction by the defendant, the foreign corporation or the foreign party in Texas, and in most cases it was completely and totally unrelated to the case of Woodford. It was like they were hired somebody to for employment, and then they purchased merchandise from some other entity in Fort Worth while they were hiring people in Houston, Texas, and things of that nature. In this particular case, their continuing course of conduct is recruiting people out of the state of Texas to go to Arizona, which is the very type of transaction that we're talking about here. So it's not an unrelated activity. It is related in that it is one of the transactions that is a continuing course of business. Whereas all of the other cases have said if there are sufficient unrelated activities, then we will go ahead on this one activity and still say they're doing business in the state of Texas. And I think that is a significant distinction.
What is your cause of action against
We have a cause of action against them based on breach of contract. That is our main cause, Your Honor, because the contract specifically provides that if they dismiss the student for whatever reason and they replace that student during that student slot in the school, then they will refund the tuition, the unused portion of it, pro rata. In this particular case, Mrs. Steinbeck testified repeatedly in the statement of facts that they had a waiting list. They represented that to Mr. Siskin at the time he signed the contract. They represented it all the way through. They've never denied that. So we're taking the position, if they have a waiting list, when he was expelled, another person was admitted. And also we've alleged a conspiracy. Because the contract, if a person would sign it without alteration, provides that once you pay that tuition and that student is admitted, the following day they can dismiss him or expel him. And the $7,000 in tuition and costs and whatever are gone forever. The parent has absolutely no right to a pro rata reimbursement of any kind. And in this case, Mr. Siskin provided that he would get a pro rata reimbursement if his son's slot was filled by another student. So we went down the list, and in a statement of fact, and here again our discovery was limited. We were denied the interrogatories that we wanted to show this for this case, because they said we were going to the district court help, we were going to the merits of the case, which I think was wrong. We wanted to show that there was a conspiracy here by these defendants or to show that the fraud was being committed. And that is, they were rolling the student body. We listed 7 or 8 students, questions, and Ms. Steinbeck testified. They were re-enrolled, but they're not there now. And she would not testify, stated she didn't know where they were or what happened to them. The presumption that I have to draw from that, and the only presumption I think that's reasonable and fair to for the court to draw, is that they were expelled. And so for the school got approximately, instead of tuition for 80 students, they got the tuition, we think, for approximately 30 to 50% more than that, because they were rolling the enrollment pretty rapidly. And this, so we have alleged fraud and conspiracy. We think these people are working at this. They eliminate students and let others in and keep all the money. It's just as simple as that. And they are a private institution operating for profit, and which is significantly different from a foundation that's a charitable organization and supported by charity. And as you know, I feel like that is the significant difference. These people are filling their own pocketbooks at the expense of parents. If they're going to do that to the tune of 10% of their total income, I think they ought to have to come to Texas and defend it. But that's where 10% of it's coming from. We feel, as set out in our brief, and I won't go through it again, that the defendants failed to negate all of the bases of jurisdiction to show why all defendants were not amenable to process under the Texas long-arm statute. I would like to refer a minute to the Court of Appeals decision in this case, and particularly to number 5, where it said the defendants appearing especially have the burden of showing lack of in personam jurisdiction. And I turn to page 807 of that opinion. It says the cause of action must arise or be connected with such act or transaction. Well, we think it was. We think that this cause of action arose out of the contract. And so there was connected. They're saying that we haven't met the three-pronged test. We feel that we have. And it says later that Texas has indicated the long-arm statute is to reach as far as the federal constitutional requirements of due process will permit. I think it appears, except for this case, the last case, the Hall versus Helico, that if a case is tried before this court on a constitutional or court of appeals, and you will get one result, whereas you will probably get another result if it doesn't meet the three-pronged test, that the transaction or the suit arose out of the transaction involved, if you go to the federal court. I think the court here in the Helico case is trying to narrow that gap, because they've alluded to the fact that it's not an absolute requirement. What we're doing is construing the Constitution. And the court says here in the Court of Civil Appeals, in the Siskin case, the factors used in the federal courts are less stringent than those purportedly used in Texas. The two factors applied in federal courts are the first and the third Texas factors. And I guess what I'm asking this court to do is to narrow the gap and maybe not go exclusively with the two-prong test as the federal courts and the United States Supreme Court have done, but do as they indicated they were inclined to recognize in the Helico case, that if you don't meet the second test, then the other test, you have a more burdensome proof as to the second test. I mean, as to the third test. And we feel that this record that was made in the court, in the district court in Houston, adequately supports all of our findings of fact. And because, number one, the statement of fact number, finding of fact number 11 and 20, the statement of fact on page 18 does not support this finding, in our opinion, because they state, and I will read the finding of fact to you. That at and prior to the commencement of this action by plaintiffs, no employees, agents, or representatives of the Villa School entered into Texas in connection with any school function or business. Well, I don't think that is quite what the record shows. She testified that they weren't residents of Texas, and to her knowledge, no one had done so. These other defendants never came forward and put forth one bit of evidence. All we had was Mrs. Steinbeck's to her knowledge. And number 20 says that none of the defendants and no representatives or employees have ever been to Texas other than the appearance of Mrs. Steinbeck as a witness of this special appearance. Now, that's not the case. Ms. Steinbeck testified this was the only time she'd ever been to Texas except when she was changing planes going through the airport. None of the other defendants testified or submitted any evidence in the record whatsoever about their contacts with Texas. And so those findings of fact just were not supported by the record. And then the Villa School had never transacted any business in Texas. That was a legal conclusion, and our opinion, I objected to it. I think that is something that she was not competent to testify on. I think that when she sent the school sent the application to 10% of their student body and solicited their enrollment, when they listed their names in phone books, when they advertised with the sole purpose of getting people from the 50 states and foreign countries, if possible, as student bodies, that they purposely were intending to come to Texas and get whatever student body they could. And for some reason, they're getting about 10% from Texas. So I feel like they are in Texas. They are doing business in Texas. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. David Smith presents arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court. My name is David Smith. I'm the attorney in this case representing the respondents, the Villa School, Villa Foundation for Education, and the individual defendants who are identified in this appeal. I think that this appeal presents a due process question only. I don't think that there's any dispute in the record that under Article 2031B, under the Texas long-arm statute, that service of process and the application of that statute are satisfied. Under the definitions of doing business in Texas under Article 2031B, entering into a contract in whole or in part in Texas, or committing a tort in whole or in part in Texas, or engaging in a recruitment function for employment, are all triggering acts which bring into play the Article 2031B. But the inquiry, thankfully, does not end there. The additional question must be, assuming Article 2031B is satisfied, let's examine the due process considerations. And in looking at this case, I think that the quotation from the from this court in the U Anchor case is applicable, which is that important constitutional rights are prove immune to solution by checklist. Because in this case, I think if you were to look at any one of the alleged jurisdiction affiliating acts, that you might think that it, for this case or for all cases, that might be enough. But thankfully, again, there's no general rule, and each case must be decided on its own face for the facts that are presented in that case. I would like to show and present argument to this court that due process and the test that this court has announced in U Anchor and O'Brien and the Helical case does not establish jurisdiction over these Arizona defendants. And secondly, with respect to the other two points of error, that we did have sufficient evidence and met our burden of proof on those points. On the due process analysis, the first question is the purposefulness of the acts that were committed within the forum state. And I think here the locus of jurisdictional facts is quite simple. We have a situation where an Arizona school, a private school, small school, did engage in advertising within the forum state. There was, in the record, there are ads in Sunset Magazine, National Geographic, Lovejoy's private school register, as well as ads that were taken out in Yellow Pages. I think the record also shows that the school didn't limit itself to Texas. They advertised in foreign countries, in the Herald Tribune abroad, and in all major metropolitan Yellow Pages, Chicago and Vancouver, Canada. So the school was making an effort to recruit and attract students through making this institution known. Now, does that act alone subject them to jurisdiction? Well, I think that the Texas cases clearly hold that the mere advertising within the forum and then ultimately entering into a contract with a Texas resident is insufficient if the defendant does not have any other activity within the state. I think that the Sunex case and the Computer Synergy case and the U-Anchor case itself stand for the proposition that merely entering into a contract with a Texas resident, if there is no performance of that contract to be performed in Texas, and if the defendant does not come into the state and actively negotiate that contract within the state and therefore subject himself or herself to jurisdiction by coming within the state, that advertising alone is not enough. And the federal courts have also applied that view. In the American Steel case, which is cited at page 17 of my brief, this had to do with an Oregon corporation who advertised its steel products. A Texas corporation negotiated and entered into a contract, a very large commercial contract. The contract was to be performed in Singapore, and the federal court held that the solicitation and negotiation of that contract with the Texas resident corporation was insufficient because performance was to occur outside of the state. And there are many cases in the Court of Civil Appeals and in this court which deal with a Texas resident entering into a contract with a foreign corporation. That act alone is not jurisdictionally sufficient under due process analysis. In the Hansen versus Dankler case, the Supreme Court stated that the unilateral activity of one within the forum state with someone who is outside of the forum state is not enough. But
counsel, in the course of your discussion, I would like for you to discuss McGee versus International Life Insurance Company.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which was a case in which an insurance company sent a contract into a state, and then the contract with that state was that the premiums were paid from the state, California in this case.
Your Honor, I'll begin.
That looks pretty close to what we've got.
If McGee were the law, I would lose this case. McGee, however, has been substantially undercut by the later. McGee was decided in 1957, and in that case, you had a situation where a out-of-state life insurance company on a single contract entered into with a California resident, and the United States Supreme Court held that was sufficient. However, the reach and authority of the McGee case was severely restricted 1 year later in the Hansen versus Dankler case, where the court specifically, the United States Supreme Court, specifically distinguished McGee on the grounds that that represented the high water mark of due process, and said that the basis for sustaining jurisdiction was that in McGee, California had enacted special legislation to protect its citizens from being injured in an activity that the state treated as exceptional, and the court discussed the fact that California had undertaken a systematic regulation of the insurance industry. But how could California regulate the insurance industry if they could have no control over foreign insurers who entered into contracts with California residents? So they said, well, in the insurance situation where the state has regulated the field and taken that area over, it would not offend due process in an activity where the state has a special interest to assume jurisdiction. And specifically, I think at page 24 of my brief, I've discussed the fact that courts have stated that that is really not the law, that the mere entering into a contract with a resident of the foreign state is not the law. And there's a Professor Thode, in his article at page 301, discusses the fact that McGee is sui generis or special. And also the Texas Civil Appeals case, Texarkana case, in the Trinity Steel case also made reference to the fact that is based upon the fact that California had a special interest in protecting its citizens in that case. Similarly, the opinion that was cited, there's an opinion in the Helical case that this court cited, I believe it was a Massachusetts case that went to the Supreme Court, and it had to do with the out-of-state service of process under the motor vehicle statute. Out-of-state resident, you could serve the Secretary of State for a motor vehicle accident. The same analysis was applied there by the commentators in the courts, that where a state has enacted special legislation or has stated that it was important to have that interest, that they could, on that basis, invoke jurisdiction. So I believe that if McGee were the law, then Hugh Anchor would have been decided differently. Helical would have been decided differently. And I believe the O'Brien case would have had to come out differently, because there you did have a Texas resident contracting with someone outside the state. And the U.S. Supreme Court also, in the Lakeside Bridge case, which is cited in my brief, in denying the petition for certiorari from the Seventh Circuit, lined up the jurisdictions that stated in commercial context, does entering into a contract with a resident of another state mean that there is jurisdiction? And the court cited the Sunex case as being, Texas is in this group of cases and is in the line of jurisdiction, but said it does not. And that's cited, I believe, in the in the Lakeside denial of cert opinion, which is cited in the briefs. I think that when you examine the question of the purposeful acts of these defendants, that their purposeful acts are really not purposeful. I mean, the advertisement in these national publications, all that represents is an effort to get a national student body. And schools like Harvard or Yale or University of Texas or Baylor, I think, should be permitted to go into other states and recruit students for athletic purposes, for scholarship purposes, for minority recruitment purposes. And I don't think that that act alone can subject that institution to jurisdiction in that forum. It would be an onerous rule, and I think that in the Court of Civil Appeals opinion, Justice Brown pointed out that he was concerned where a local activity of the school, where it is understood that the student is going to go to school where the school is, that all performance is going to occur where the school is, that on those facts, the parties understand and contemplate that the locus of activity is going to be in the foreign state, or going to be where the school is. Second point, I think, on this purpose, so I think that the evidence that we presented shows that the advertisements and the negotiating of this enrollment contract, those facts alone do not decide the case. There is no checklist approach here, and on balance, this school has no contact at all to Texas, other than entering into an enrollment contract with students from Texas. On the point of the 10% figure, we always seem to come back to this in various courts that we've been through. I would just state that it's not true and it's not relevant. First, the record, and I believe I've pointed this out in my brief again, that there was never any evidence or proof that 10% of the students from the Phillips School came from Texas. But even if that were the proof, I don't think that's relevant, or how much money the school makes from Texas, although that was not in the record at any point either. The issue is, what about the purposeful acts? Do these acts have a nexus to the forum? And is it fair to subject the defendant to jurisdiction? The specific pages of the record show that that was a question which Mr. Campbell asked. Do 10% of the students come from Texas? Which the witness never answered. And it was merely an unanswered question. She answered it was a compound question, and there's nothing in the record to support that. But it's not really relevant, because the number of students that come from the Villa School, whether it was 11 students or one student, if the act is sufficient for one, it would be sufficient for 10. If it's insufficient for one, it's insufficient for 10. I think that the analysis under due process doesn't change. We can't go to a test that's how big was the contract or how important was the negotiation. So I think that that issue is sort of a sidelight issue. The question of nexus to the forum, however, is something that this court really, I think, has resolved in its Helical opinion. We filed our briefs on February 2nd. This court handed down Helical February 24th. At that time, there was some question about that second requirement, the nexus requirement, but I think now, in accordance with what the federal courts have done, Texas law, state law is clear that nexus is important, and it factors into the third analysis point in the O'Brien test. Well, again, in this case, there is no nexus between acts or the causes of action and Texas. The advertisements that are in question are not alleged to be any part of the cause of action. The jurisdictional acts of contract are not related to the failure to pay tuition. And the other causes of action, the DTPA action, the tort theory, the conspiracy theory, none of those have any connection to Texas. The acts of the
deception.
A deception?
Yes.
Your Honor, if a deception occurred in this case, it would have occurred in Arizona. I think that
if you lure somebody from Texas to do something, you get to Arizona and let's say it's a vacation package, and you tell them you've got a great lodge and all this, and they get out there and there is no such.
Well, that's an interesting point. There is a case on sort of similar to that, the Cross versus Del Webb Hotel. You have a Las Vegas hotel that advertises people to go on a junket to Las Vegas. They go and find that the rooms are not exactly what they wanted, and they attempt to sue the Las Vegas Hotel in Texas, and the federal court in Texas in that case held there was no jurisdiction. Again, I think that it's a single act, a unilateral act, a single act case where there's no purposeful activity is going to be a problematic case. But I think if one could show that there was a systematic effort to engage in false advertising in Texas, and that if it was sufficient upon the facts, I think you could have a case there for jurisdiction. I think, you know, it would be a different case than this case. Because in this case, there's no contention that these advertisements are related to the cause of action. But if it was a false advertising case, I think it would still be very marginal. There are some mail order cases. If a Texas resident buys a product from a New York concern, or a New York resident buys a bit from Hughes Tool Company, can Hughes be sued in New York for not selling it or for not conforming to its promise? Generally speaking, the courts have said that there has to be a purposeful act and some minimum contacts with the forum. And I think that single act case is always going to be the most difficult case to resolve. But in this case, there is just no nexus between the acts of the Villa School or the defendants and the causes of action that are asserted or the forum state. All the complaint of activity is Arizona-based. And Arizona law would govern this contract. Although Mr. Siskind deleted the consent to jurisdiction clause that was in this contract, which would be some evidence that the school, in each of its contracts, wanted to have disputes resolved in Arizona by having this form in the contract. Mr. Siskind, an attorney, struck that out and said, just X'd it out. He was not consented to jurisdiction in Arizona. The evidence also shows that when Mrs. Steinbeck signed that, it was in the stack of all the enrollment forms, and she didn't really read it and had no idea that that had been done. But The contract was accepted by the school in Arizona, and the last act necessary to complete the contract was the signature by the school in Arizona. So that, and the contract was to be performed in Arizona by taking Mark Siskin as a student. So under any choice of law analysis, either under Arizona conflicts of law principles or Texas conflicts of law principles, this would be an Arizona law contract. There was no choice of law provision in the contract, but under conflicts principles, this would be an Arizona contract. I think that the Helical case that this court decided is really provides authority for affirmance of this case, because in the Helical case, the Williams Sedco Horn Venture negotiated the joint venture in Houston, came to Texas for that purpose, purchased the helicopter in Fort Worth, and there was a requirement there that they had to buy insurance. All of those things this court rejected as saying, well, true, but unconnected to the helicopter crash in Peru involving pilot error, not material, not relevant. Same is true in this case. It's even stronger in this case. Although there were advertisements and negotiation of the contract, the alleged causes of action have no relationship to Texas, other than the contract cause of action itself. However, the alleged breach of contract is unconnected to those acts. So I think that the nexus point is very clear, and the only point that there's some debate on would be the nexus relationship to the contract cause of action, but I think that the purposefulness there is clearly negated by the school's activities.
Did you know that we bring the motion for rehearing in the helicopter case?
No, Your Honor, I did not. Well, that clearly, I take back everything I said. No, I did not know that, but I would say that the authority of that case, I think, is the principle on nexus and what it says. It would be applicable here, and I think that the resolution of that is would support affirmance in this case. The second point that I think is interesting is the fact that this school the plaintiffs have instituted suit in Arizona, and I have filed a motion for stay or abatement or an alternative affirmance. The notion that this was simply a protective filing to prevent the tolling of limitations is not really true, because they're proceeding with discovery in Arizona, and I think that that is a material point. And I think for the reasons set forth in my motion, it would be appropriate to consider a stay of this appeal. The next point that comes under my argument concerns the burden of proof issue on the individual defendants. The law in Texas apparently is that I had the burden of proof. I was mindful of that. It's sort of at odds with the plea of privilege rule. In a plea of privilege case, the plaintiff has the burden. But in a case involving constitutional principles, the defendant has the burden. That rule is different in state court than in federal court. But nevertheless, we met that burden. We met that burden because the petition, both petitions, affirmatively alleged that the defendants were Arizona residents. We offered testimony from the school's director that all the individual defendants were residents and domiciliaries of Arizona. The contention that we didn't prove that they didn't have other residencies is really off the mark, because we did prove that the school sends no one to Texas. None of these individuals, other individuals, had ever been to Texas in connection with school functions, and the theory that the individuals were being sued under was an agency theory. So I would suggest that if we introduce evidence that none of the individuals in connection with their school activities came to Texas, that and the suit against the individuals is premised on an agency theory, then we have met our burden of proof by showing that the individuals are not residents of Texas, are not subject to doing business here. We also introduced proof that Mrs. Steinbeck testified that no one from the school had come here either on business or for recruiting functions. And I think that the issue of what is the burden to negate all possible bases of jurisdiction or only those pleaded bases of jurisdiction may be up in the air with the TM Productions case. But under either test, I think that we met the burden of establishing by a preponderance of the evidence that the individual defendants did not have any contact with the forum or had plainly substantial contacts. Finally, on the point concerning the sufficiency of evidence of the factual findings that were entered by the trial court, this is a case where findings of fact and conclusions of law were entered by Judge Ferris after the trial to Judge Compton. Those findings of facts and conclusions of law are important in a 120A case, and I think each of those findings is supported by the record. And the record, as set forth in the brief, cites the various portions of the record which support those factual findings. In conclusion, I think that in this case, the due process analysis is what has to control the disposition of the case. And it would be a harsh result and a new watershed, really, for Texas jurisdiction, Texas jurisprudence, and across the nation for the law to be that a school may be sued wherever it takes a student from. That's the inevitable result of a reversal in this case. I think that the advertisements and the activities of this school do not rise to the level of purposefully availing themselves of the privilege of doing business in Texas. This is not a case where representatives of the school ever came to Texas. This is not a case where the school expected to have Texas law apply or expected that there would be any consequences within the forum state for they were simply taking a student from Arizona. For all these reasons, I would urge that this court affirm the decision below.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take a brief recess before we go to the argument.
The audience will please run. Maybe we can get the marshal to fix my chair.
The U-Anchor cases and most all of the cases that the defendant has relied upon were handed down prior to the amendment to Section 4 of Article 2031B, which applies to recruitment. And it seemed to me that possibly that amendment might have been prompted by the holding of some of the cases that have been before the courts, in Texas courts, concerning people who were recruited to go to foreign places. And I think in each case it involved a helicopter crash where there was a loss of life. And these people were recruited in Texas and hired in Texas, but they were not, none of the plaintiffs were residents of Texas. And none of the only contact with Texas was possibly the negotiation of a contract in Texas, and I think that's an Arizona case as well as the Helico case. And based on that, since there were no plaintiffs here, the minimal contact test with Texas was not met, and that's where I held. So they have enlarged that. It seems to me like they've enlarged the statute to say, if you come to Texas and recruit people, even though they're not residents of Texas, then the Texas courts are going to have jurisdiction over the defendants who did the recruiting. Maybe that's, there's no cases on that, but I'm reading the last sentence of the statute literally for what it says. Which, again, I will say, the act of recruiting Texas residents directly or through an intermediary located in Texas. In other words, it seems to me an intermediary, I could rationale and say they had an employment agency recruit for them and hired them and they went somewhere else. That would be constitute doing business in Texas, and if anything arose out of that transaction, then the courts of Texas would have jurisdiction. I cannot see very much difference between that than the Villa School sending the applications to the parents, saying, your son is invited to, or daughter, case may be, is invited to enroll in this school. And if you will sign this contract, we will enroll. That seems to me like very similar to an employment contract. That is a purposeful act of the school. They came, and it was done here. And it was breached here because they loaded the boy on the plane, same to Arizona, in reliance on the contract. So part of the acts were purposeful here, and I feel like the representations were made here, that he would be refunded the tuition if he was removed for any reason by mailing him back a copy to Texas. And
McGee, I would like your views on whether you agree with the argument that the United States Supreme Court has substantially retreated from the McGee high water position.
I don't read it that way, Your Honor. I don't read that they have. They stated that that was a special case. There was a statute. I think if the court were going to have retreated from that position, they would have said that that they would have been stronger in their retreat and backing off from that position. There was a statute enacted. We have a statute enacted regarding recruitment. I think if a company came to Texas through an intermediary and recruited one man under this statute, I think the Texas courts would have jurisdiction here. And that's the same thing as McGee. There was a statute enacted by the legislature to protect the citizens of the state or to protect the business activity being carried on in the state, whichever the case may be. In this case, we have a citizen of the state as well, which has gone one step farther. And really what could happen in the Helico case, which is distinguishable. For example, you say, no evidence has been presented, however, indicating that the negotiations in any way dealt with the deceased workers or any matters leading or contributing to the helicopter crash in Peru. Well, that is true, but in our case, the contract was negotiated through the mails, and it directly involved, this case arose out of that contract, whereas the minimum contact test here is something else. So I think this case can be distinguished, the Helico case. I think our case is stronger than the Helico case in that regard.
Would you comment, please, sir, on the case cited by counsel correspondent on the Las Vegas hotel who solicited guests in Texas? As I understood it, it was held not to constitute a minimum contact.
Well, let me say this. I read that case, and I am inclined to think that that was sufficient minimum contacts in that case because they called him on telephone, they sent him brochures, they gave him special guest rates, and it was a continuing deal with Texas residents, and a large portion of their income came from Texas. And I feel like that they should have, the people in East Texas should have been able to prevail, bring their litigation in the Federal District Court of Texas. I don't agree with it. I read the case, and I don't necessarily agree with it. I think it's a district court case. I don't think that case follows the Supreme Court of the United States cases.
Well, it would be, that would indicate that, at least as far as that court is concerned, that there was a retreat from the McGee holding.
I think that's a retreat by a district court, but I didn't see any cases of the Fifth Circuit or any court of Federal Court of Appeals or Supreme Court cases that even approached a retreat, Your Honor. I think the trend is, in all the cases that I've cited in my brief, the trend is to go the other way. And I think, you can read in underlying inference is, they talk about convenience of the parties, the relative convenience of the parties. I think it'd be much more convenient for the school to come to Texas than it would for Mr. Siskin and his son Mark to have to go out, have to be withdrawn from school for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks to go to Arizona and try this case for breach of contract. I think the inconvenience is just astronomical in comparison. And they talk about the ease of transportation and the mode of transportation, etc. We have a case here that I used in my brief, involved a case of it is O'Brien versus Lampac Company, where O'Brien went to Illinois, and Lampac representative president went to Illinois and employed the services of an attorney in Chicago to file a lawsuit. All he did apparently was sign an employment agreement, discuss the case, and came back to Texas.
Counsel, he actually physically went to Illinois, sat down in the lawyer's office, signed the contract up there, and was personally present at the time the contract upon which the suit was brought was executed.
I read that. But my point is, Your Honor, I cannot really see why the courts draw a distinction between the physical presence into the state when we have today the facilities to, by express mail and everything, put something on an airplane in Austin or Houston at 8 o'clock, it'd be in Arizona or California by mid-afternoon, they review it and have it back on the plane the next afternoon. I think these cases grew out of the fact that people actually physically went to negotiate the contract because the mails were so slow and it took so long to do a communication set, telecopy and what have you, that it took so long to work out a contract, they did it in the interest of time. They physically must have present there. I can't see the significance of my coming to Austin, Texas, and negotiating a contract with a party here, as opposed to my picking up the telephone, negotiating that contract, dictating it to my secretary, send it to the Austin attorney, or Austin office, and back. I can't see why that should make a difference.
Your rule would be that if there is an exchange of a letter, that will fix jurisdiction in a foreign jurisdiction.
I think that as a continuing course of conduct, that should be the case, yes, sir, Your Honor. I think it, because I can't see why the physical presence makes any difference whatsoever. The man is relieved of his money, he paid his money, he does the same thing as he would if he physically went there and signed a contract and then went back home and honored his part of the contract. I can't see his physical presence making a significant difference. It has been a mark that the courts have looked at, but more and more the federal courts seem to be getting away from that. They did in the McGee case. That was the only life insurance policy that company had in the state of California. The only one that they received money in Texas from. But in our case, we've got 10% of the student body receiving money, which is significant change, or much stronger. So I can't see why, if they would hold it under that case, why they shouldn't hold it in this case, especially in light of the amendment to Section 4 of the long-arm statute, which addresses employment and recruitment. That's all I have, gentlemen.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much for your time.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Going to be a problematical case, but I think if one could share